Sex Bob-omb, and we're here to make you think about death and get sad and stuff.
I'm hearing voices, animal voices, the tremor of cold, the feminine atmosphere, reaching my threshold, staring at the truth till I'm blind.
The world is spinning like it normally spins. And today we are joined with special guest Gregory Lamberson, who is a widely acclaimed guy who makes words and makes movie things and does all sorts of other fun stuff like that. Hello, Greg. How's it going?
Hello, Bill. Or should I call you Zombie? Or should I call you Winter like all your friends do?
You can call me whatever as long as you don't call me late for cookies.
Okay, whatever.
Whatever works too. So how's the weather in Buffalo? Buffalo.
It is a gorgeous first day of fall following a gorgeous summer. We earned it after last winter.
Wait, was winter bad, rough for you guys last year?
Extremely long, extremely cold, extremely deep.
And there was like lots of snow, wasn't there?
Wait a minute, that's like a porn film.
Hey, speaking of that, didn't you just make a movie called Killer Rack?
I did indeed make a movie called Killer Rack.
So I had one quick question to start off with that. What prompted the idea behind a movie such as that about a nice young lady who goes and gets bigger boobs infected by the spawn of Cthulhu-type peoples?
Well, this is the first feature that I've directed that somebody else wrote. So I can't imagine what was going through Paul McGinnis's head when he came up with this story. But when I read the script, I laughed out loud from beginning to end and immediately reread it and laughed out loud again and knew I had to direct it.
Excellent. I know I laughed a lot during the movie watching it, right from the beginning with Debbie and then throughout. It's like, oh, geez, right with the art critic. That's funny.
Well, the thing that I like about this film is that the reactions have been, people have actually watched it more than once and pick up on jokes they missed the first time with each viewing, and that's kind of the way we did it. You know, it's pun heavy, it's visual sight gag heavy, and there's just a lot of different layers to it so that it's worth watching more than once.
Now I'm going to go out on a limb and guess you like the Evil Dead movies as well.
Yeah, I'm not a fanatic about them. I can't wait for the new show, but you know, I like them the same way I like the Elm Street films or any of these other things. I don't worship them or watch them four times a year, but I like them a lot.
No, I thought I caught a reference to an Evil Dead thing in the movie.
Well, again, that was in the screenplay.
Gotcha.
And a lot of that I take no credit for. The process, basically, is I took Paul out to coffee the day after I read the script, and I said, okay, I really want to direct it. I said, I think it needs a totally different ending than what you have. And we spent a couple of months just expanding some things and compressing some things and smoothing out some dialogue. And I had a bunch of sight gags that I wanted to add. So not all of the sight gags in the film, but a lot of them are mine. And all of the puns are Paul's. But the story of the script stayed, and the characters stayed pretty consistent throughout the whole process.
Excellent. And if I remember correctly, you guys filmed this last year during, August, September, that time frame?
Yeah, we shot on weekends in August and September. Every weekend. I took off, I think, one weekend to do Fan Expo last year. Different process for me, shooting on weekends than shooting over 18 days split up over, say, 3.5 weeks. It's nice because you can recharge your batteries and organize things that may seem disorganized. But it's weird, like that sound, that you also have to get your juices going and have a new first day every weekend.
So is it like start again, then stop, and then start again, then stop?
In terms of the shooting, yeah, but I mean the whole week I would spend doing prep work, you know, lining up this, recasting this, making this piece fit in. There was never any real downtime.
Oh, cool. You got a lot of people listed as cast and crew on this movie.
It's by far the biggest cast I've ever had. There were so many characters, and Paul and I actually added characters before we started shooting. There were people that we wanted to get into the film, and there were certain little bits that I thought could fit in here. The art critic you mentioned wasn't in the original draft. Some of the female office workers who bully Betty were added. Some of the victims were expanded upon. Because it's a comedy, I went into it kind of thinking I want this to be it's a mad, 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 mad world of micro-budget horror films.
And I personally thought that it came across that way.
Thank you.
It was like, wait a sec, this is, oh, geez, that's just funny. For people who don't know what the movie's about, give them a brief synopsis, if you would.
Betty Downer is a unhappy worker in a collections agency where she sees that all of the women around her are appreciated by her boss because of their large breasts, and she's rather flat-chested. And her boyfriend pays no attention to her, and she's just in a funk and gets it into her head that larger breasts will turn her life around. So she goes to see a plastic surgeon named Dr. Kate Thulu, and played by Debbie Rashan, and she does indeed get the surgery, and her life seems to be on an uptick. There's just one catch, make that two. Her new breast implants are actually man-eating, Lovecraftian monsters, hell-bent on world domination. Betty can stop them if she can find the strength to do so within her.
World domination is a great theme.
Well, they're certainly an ambitious pair of tits.
Well, exactly. And was the name you gave him Momoan? Momoa?
Memoria.
Memoria. Definitely not what I can recall from Lovecraft normally, so I'm assuming that one was a created one?
Well, I mean, let's be honest. H.P. Lovecraft grew up in a time where there was a lot of repression of women, and those elder gods just simply didn't get their due.
Gotcha.
We're in a more enlightened time now, which is why we can have a film like Killer Rack.
I agree. But did you go into the movie with the intent of moral story as well? It's like, you don't need to have bigger boobs to be a nicer person?
There was definitely that subtext to it. And when I read the script, it was so funny to me, but what connected to me was what I saw as being the rather sweet love story between Betty and her co-worker Tim, played by Paul McGinnis, the screenwriter. And I really appreciated that part of the story. And there was sort of a moralistic aspect to the original ending, because I don't think this is a big spoiler. Betty got killed at the end, just like my lead in Slime City and the hero in Basket Case and all these films where the character, say, gets possessed and does all these horrible things, he has to pay a price at the end. And I just didn't really want to go that route, and I thought the audience was going to like Betty so much that the film would be a complete downer if she perished. So I pitched Paul my idea of what the ending should be with her surviving, and he discarded it, kept my idea of her surviving, but put his own twist on it.
I kind of liked how the, spoiler alert, boobs were removed and just sort of jumped around all of themselves.
Yeah, we went the Slime City route, basically. In my film Slime City and the sequel Slime City Massacre, the brains emerge from the severed heads and run across the floor. And we said, okay, well, we can play that up with boobs.
Yes, it worked well. Boobs running across the thing looking like that is like, oh my God, it's terrible! But that's funny. It was really neat.
We went very visual with like the 12-minute sequence at the end of the film, whereas up to that point, for the most part, any of the boob activities or murders like are either in the dark or off-screen and played for laugh. There is one in the middle that's pretty bloody where she eats her way through the guy's back and blood emerges from his chest.
I like that one. As well with the one with the two, I believe you guys called them the douchebags in the alleyway.
Yes. And, it's a fairly dry film in that sense until the ending, and then it's just blood, 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 blood.
I was going to say, it's like, for a movie about a killer rack, it was a minimum amount of blood throughout the movie, and then a minimum amount of boobs.
Well, my au revoir of films, I don't want to say they're famous, but I'm known for having a minimal amount of nudity. I think when you do a low-budget film, it's wrong to make a chick take off her top if you can't at least pay her.
Exactly, and I would agree with that.
And also, I mean, people are going to go into this expecting there to be a certain salacious quality to it and are going to be surprised that it really is kind of a sweet, fun movie that just happens to have a lot of blood and sexual innuendo in it. And I think if we had played up the nudity more than we did, and there's a little bit in there, a tiny bit, it would have been a case of trying to be something that we weren't and betraying what we were. I felt that going the route, the tone that we did was probably truer to the film we wanted to make.
Cool. Now, I had one quick question because I was looking at the list of cast and crew here. Brooke Lewis as Killer Rack, I didn't connect with how she was in the movie.
Brooke Lewis, who's appeared in many films and was in My Phone Slime City Massacre, is the voice of the boobs.
Gotcha. I was
throughout the film when Betty is possessed by them, she sleepwalks around, and one of the jokes is that guys are so fixated on her breast that they don't even realize her mouth isn't moving, and another voice is coming from the breasts. And Brooke is the voice that comes from the breasts and which comes out of the puppets at the end.
Gotcha. Because what I was thinking is like, wait, they just got the lady playing Betty, Jessica, to throw her voice differently. Oh, okay, that was weird. But I got the bit about not moving the mouse. Like, yeah, she's sleepwalking and the boobs are taking over.
Yeah, until the film's out on DVD and widely seen by people, and people start talking about the end in greater detail, Brooke sort of has to sit in the corner watching the other actors get their accolades because her part is sort, I don't want to say secret, but you know, you can't discuss it too much without spoiling some of the cool stuff.
Gotcha. Well, everybody knows that this is a spoiler alert filled show, so if they don't get that from the beginning, I'm not going to say any more.
I wasn't speaking about you, Bill Winter Zombies Act. I was speaking in just in general, that in terms of the reviews I've seen and the press we've gotten, the more secretive aspects seem to be something that people are respecting, so she's not getting a lot of attention this early on.
I gotcha. I just say my mind about everything. It's like, wait a second, I couldn't figure out what she was doing. Oh, okay, now I get it. So, most of these people that are in the movie, they're local to the Buffalo area?
Yeah, the out-of-towners were Debbie, of course, and Lloyd Kaufman, an actor named Michael Thurber, who plays the boss, the bald fellow with the expressive face, who's amazing in it, I think. And Roy Frumkus plays a character who walks on at the end. Other than those four, you know, the other 20 or 30 people in the cast are all local to Buffalo, including Jessica.
Nice. So, Lloyd Kaufman, you mentioned him. He was an icon in the horror industry and all that stuff. How did we connect him into it?
Lloyd did a cameo for my film Slime City Massacre. And he did it strictly as a favor for me, and a favor I didn't even ask for. He's good friends with Debbie Rashan, who I cast in Slime City Massacre, and she was telling him, Lloyd, this film's going to be really special. I think you want to be part of it. So we offered to come down and do a cameo.
Cool.
As a result of that cameo, I'm the subject of a couple of the trauma videos. And, he came to town to shoot Poltergeist before that, and more recently came in to shoot Nukem High 1 and 2. And, I consulted with him, you know, a little bit as far as recommending people to his people, helping out wherever I could without actually being on set. I had just finished working on Debbie Rashan's Model Hunger, and they asked me to be their line producer, and I was just too tired to go from one shoot into the other, so I had to beg off. But I've stayed in touch with him, you know, appearing on the same festivals and so forth. And when Paul and I got together, we worked out all the casting together. We thought he would make a great Dr. Foyne, Betty's psychiatrist, because I knew he could bring out a certain Mel Brooks-like quality. That's what I was seeing.
Most definitely.
It was very easy. I mean, I sent an email, and he just wanted to know the dates, and we worked out his flights, and he was here. And it's, I mean, it's not a huge part, but it's a much bigger part than he normally does in these films. He usually has a goofy walk-on. We made sure he had three full scenes, including the big musical number, so there's a little character arc, and he was great to work with. I mean, I know the documentaries on his films show him yelling at his crew, and I've seen him do that to his crew, but on our film, as an actor, he was a pleasure to work with. Perfect gentleman, and has been very supportive of the film. In fact, he was a guest at Scarecon, where we had our world premiere a couple of weeks ago, where we won Best Feature. And I think he was really surprised by how many people came up to him after the film and told him how much they liked him and how much they liked it.
Well, he's always been a very approachable person from what I can recall. I saw him at one convention where he just started talking to one guy in the middle of the aisle, and then an entire lineup forms behind that one guy to start talking to him.
Well, we had the world premiere of Return to Nukem High Volume 1 at my film festival, Buffalo Dreams Fantastic Film Festival.
Yeah.
And he stayed after he did a huge presentation before the film. He did a huge Q&A after the film. And then he must have stayed in the lobby for 90 minutes after that, signing things for people. The theater had to stay open late just so he could do that. And then he went out and went to the bar and partied with them. So
awesome.
He makes the most of it.
Cool. Well, that's what horror is about, right? It's about interconnecting with people and being productive with everybody, and everybody trying to do a better job or better thing.
If you say so, Bill Winters, Zombies Act.
Well, I like to say so because other people might say otherwise. And gosh darn it, I'm going to project a positive attitude on everything because freak it.
I thought it was about scaring people, but I'm superficial that way.
The scaring people's the fun part. The more important part is working together and stuff.
Well, I certainly did that working on the film. It was a community effort. Everybody pulled together, and it was a great cast and crew.
Well, that's good. That's good to hear. I mean, I like hearing about movies where everybody is, like, they're enjoying the job. I mean, it's not just a matter of, I'm getting paid to do a thing, I'll do my best, but whatever. No, I enjoy doing this, and that's what I like to see more about people in movies.
Well, I mean, there's certainly those types of films, and there's films that are a lot worse than that, where it's an absolutely miserable experience because there's all sorts of conflict and behind-the-scenes nonsense, and there was none of that on this. I mean, everyone really had a good time working on it, and you could tell that they were happy to be there every day.
Excellent. So you mentioned Debbie Rochon earlier. She's an awesome actress, been in a variety of things.
Yes, Debbie was fantastic in my film Slime City Massacre, and then I brought her back and cast her in a dual role in Dry Bones, where she played a succubus, for which she won Best Actress at the Erie Horror Film Festival.
Yay!
She cameoed in a film I produced called The Legend of Six Fingers, and we both worked together in less important capacities on Battle Dogs and on Fred Olen Ray's recent film Trial, which shot in Buffalo. And she's got a film out now called Model Hunger, which she directed, and I was the line producer and first AD on that. So we worked together quite a few times, and when I discussed the casting with Paul, I said, I think Debbie should play this character, because she had told me, I asked her on Slime City Massacre, what's the one role you have never gotten to play that you want to play? And she said, I really want to play a mad scientist. So I said, Debbie would be perfect for Dr. Kate Fulu. And Paul said, that's who I wrote it for. So she was a natural. We brought her out. She's only in a handful of scenes, but she's in a full 15 minutes of the movie. And we shot all of that in 2 days. So, she's a pro as always. She brings out the best in the actors she works with. And in this one, because it's a comedy, it was really interesting to watch. Debbie's sort of like me. I mean, we're not dry Hitchcockian people who map out every little shot and beat and movement. We get in there and we want to play a little and invent and see what develops and sort of shapes the scene before we shoot it. And as Dr. Kay Fulu, her line readings from take to take were completely different. So in the editing, it was really hard to decide which version was the funniest and which version played well with the next line and which version of the next line was the funniest. So there were some tough choices to make there.
Cool. That's like I love Debbie's character as she played it as the mad scientist with the I was like, what? That was really well done the way she was doing all that. The little crab walking scene at the beginning I thought was funny as hell.
That was hers. Yeah. She came up with that scene was a 6-page script scene, and usually script scenes are 3 pages. So we had a lot of dialogue. And I had already decided I'm just going to shoot this scene from every which angle, and the editor will figure out what works best. Well, she came in and said, you know what? I want to bring a lot more physicality to this scene, which made my job a lot harder. She came up with that crab walk. She came up with a bit where she emerges from the surgery room and screams, another failure, and throws herself on the floor and has a baby temper tantrum. She comes up with a lot of stuff.
Excellent. No, I thought that was hilarious, the way I was like, wait a second, I'm thinking Exorcist here, but what's... okay, that worked.
And it's funny, the actor who plays her, Igor, Bob Bozek, he's also been in, you know, many if not all of the films I worked on, and he plays a really sleazy character in her film Model Hunger, so she directed him in that, and I mean, really pushed him, because that's a much more disturbing film, and you need a different kind of performance. And then they got to have fun together, you know, just playing off each other. It was really fun to see them working off each other.
And it seemed natural, even.
Well, they're pros.
Excellent. That's what's supposed to happen. And I noticed
it actually is when you hire someone like Debbie. Or Michael Thurber, who plays the boss, Mr. Rockwell, you know they're going to bring a certain level of quality and professionalism, and you're not surprised, really, when they hit it all out of the ballpark, because that's why you bring them to town and why you want them to anchor the film.
So now, is Paul and yourself Lovecraftian fans? Because I'm looking at the name for Bob Bozek's character, Nurse Herbie East. Which I thought was an amusing play on Herbert West.
Yes, that's a little amusing joke, primarily for the people who look at the film on IMDb. Originally, his character in the script was Male Nurse, and I think I said, you know, you should really give him a name, make him a real character. And Paul came up with Nurse Herbie East.
Nice.
I know that I've certainly read my share of Lovecraft and have seen many films which had very little to do with him while purporting to be Lovecraftian. I don't know if Paul has read them or if he's just a fan of the movies, but obviously he had a firm grasp on the lore.
Gotcha. Well, enough to get the Cthulhu elements in and the whole Elder God stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, obviously HP didn't write about tentacles coming out of boobs, but, you know.
Well, if he did in Japan, it's big.
We hit... the nails on the head that we get.
Speaking of which, do you have any film festivals that showing in Japan? Because they love tentacles.
We do not. And in fact, when I did my research, and I continue to do my research on film festivals, at least on the submission services, Film Freeway and Without a Box, there are very few Japanese horror film festivals.
Really? I would have thought there would have been a ton of them, because there's a crap load of movies they make.
I guess they're too busy actually releasing them in theaters.
Could be, I guess.
I mean, they have a lot of extreme cinema over there. I remember I thought Slime City Massacre was the wildest thing I had ever done, with Debbie melting into a bathtub full of slime and her face emerging from it. But the foreign sales reps for Japan said it was too tame for them. I was like, really? Okay.
What's the most extreme film that you think you've seen?
Oh, Jesus.
Just out of curiosity.
I have to say, the Japanese film submission that I recently got for Buffalo Dreams called The Discharged Murderer, which was a 45-minute kind of puppety, kind of animated film set in Excrement City, where all of the characters were played by pieces of shit. That was pretty extreme.
Okay. I'll giggle at that because there's a movie I'm aware of called Zombie Ass, which I'm never planning on watching, which is about shit zombies.
Yeah, I mean, I got to say, I don't think it's because I've become an old fuddy-duddy, but I'm less interested in things that are there just to shock me and don't really enjoy being shocked.
Yeah, well, there are certain things that is like, who really cares? But I guess there's a market for everything, right? Human Centipede did well.
There is someone for everything.
Pretty much. And that's unfortunate sometimes and fortunate because the diversity makes it happy things and whatever else you want to call that. But you mentioned film festivals. So you were also hosting a film festival there, I believe you mentioned, and that I read somewhere.
I do Buffalo Dreams Fantastic Film Festival every year. I have a partner, Chris Cioli. It's a 7-day festival, and we do all-day programming. So we show upwards of 25 features and maybe 50 short films. And we show horror, sci-fi, fantasy, action, anything basically that we deem cool. We try to find a slot for. This year we also have a lot. We have a lot of science fiction this year.
Cool.
We run November 6th to 12th. We are affordably priced. We're a filmmaker-friendly event, and we've had filmmakers come from Mexico and the UK, and I think we put on a pretty impressive show.
How long has it been running? How many years?
We're going into our fourth year as Buffalo Dreams, but before that we ran for 3 years as Buffalo Screams when it was intended to be solely a horror film festival, but we ended up always showing something like a Western here or a sci-fi film there or a hard to define film that it made more sense to just open ourselves up and show a lot of different things.
Cool. So that's pretty cool. Now, I tend to go all over the place when I'm interviewing, and on top of that, I tend to be very random about stuff. So if your film festival goes like that, is it easier for you to integrate into other film festivals as you were putting your submissions out, or is it harder?
I don't think it makes any difference at all.
Oh,
now,
okay.
I will give you an example. I have submitted this film to 62 film festivals that will run through the end of the summer. So basically a year-long endeavor.
Right.
Maybe 40 of them are before January. We've gotten into so far 8. We've been rejected by a dozen. I think that's a pretty good success ratio. But I have people who have accepted the film who have no idea I made Slime City. And when I tell people that I run a festival here, they said, oh, I had no idea. You don't always know the other film festival directors by name.
Right.
But I've gotten to know quite a few of them, and I enjoy that, and they actually send films our way. You know, because we're later in the year, the films that select for October, the films that they can't fit in that they really like, they try to find out home for with other festivals. So we've been the recipient of some of that.
Nice.
So film festival directors and programmers can be pretty cool.
Cool. And somebody getting a new film out, how is their best approach to trying to get into breaking into that whole process? Because obviously it's not a simple go onto the web and look something up and start doing stuff. There has to be a whole process for getting through to that submission stuff, right?
Well, I mean, different festivals handle it in a different way. I know a lot of them have entire committees who will watch every film and make a recommendation, and then they sort of use a point system to see what gets in and what gets out. Me and my partner this year, we watched every single film ourselves, and we're in the process now of narrowing it down to what it's going to be. But we got 300 submissions. And as I said, we can show, counting features and shorts, we can show maybe 70 films, probably closer to 60. So that's about 20%. Now, I'm very excited that one of the festivals we're playing at is the Spooky Movie International Horror Film Festival, which is billed as a Washington, D.C. festival, but it's actually in Maryland. And it's at the prestigious American Film Institute Silver Theater. And I am so excited to be part of this, and I want to go to that theater, and I'm going to drive all day with my friends and see the film and do a Q&A and then drive all night back. without taking a rest, really. But I mean, that's a pretty big festival. I've heard about it for years. And I realized as I was looking at the schedule that they only play one feature a night on their weeknights. So they're showing a total, I believe, of 12 films, one of which is The Final Girls. So they're showing maybe 11 films that were submissions.
Right.
And if I got 300 submissions, they probably got 500 or 600 submissions. So to be one of the 12 films that gets in there, I mean, is great for us, but it shows you just how hard it is. And my feeling is that every festival has its own personality. Every programmer has his own personality. It's just we were saying there's someone for everything. There is a festival out there for most films. The problem is, how does the filmmaker know which ones to submit to? And you have to spend a lot of time researching them. And I think that what you find out is you learn a lot more about the festivals after you've been chosen or rejected and how they treat the filmmakers than you do during the hours you spend reading about them and their rules and what they're all about and this and that. You learn a lot more in how they treat the filmmakers. So I think it's almost a requirement to go through it once and probably fail to know how to do it properly the next time and who to bother with and who not to bother with.
And that's kind of what we a lot of writers say about writing as well, right? I mean, you write a book, you write a story, you submit it all over the place, and then look at how often you get rejected, and then you either grow or learn from that or you give up.
That's true, but I would argue that a key difference is that you can write a novel, let's say in 6 months, maybe 9 months, maybe a year. It's about 6 months for me. It doesn't cost you anything except for your own time and sacrifice. And then when you send it out, it doesn't cost you anything to submit. Now, for a film, you spend 6 months to a year to 2 years with a lot more sacrifice. And then to send it out and submit it to these festivals, you have to pay a lot of money. You know, I was looking at one the other day. They advertise themselves as, hey, we've extended our early bird deadline. The early bird deadline is the first segment of the submission period where it's at its cheapest. And then for each successive period, the money, the cost to submit increases. And this is set by the film submission platforms, Film Freeway and Without a Box. The film festival directors have no say in that. When we ran Buffalo Screams, we didn't use those submission services. And we charged a flat fee for the entire submission period, which is how we'd like it to be. But they mandate these increases so they can make more money. And you get so many more submissions when you use them that you really have to play by their rules.
Gotcha. I've actually never heard of that process. So I was like, okay, that's interesting. So I
saw a festival the other day who was saying, hey, we've extended our early bird deadline by 2 weeks. So submit your film now. I said, all right, well, let me take a look. So I went to their page and features, shorts, medium length films, music videos, whatever, everything had the same price, the low, low price of $50. Now, in our submission process, we're $50 for a feature, you know, at the end of the period when it gets at its highest, and you charge less for the shorter the film. This guy was just flat out charging $50 for everything right at the start of the year. To me, that kind of screams scam, and it takes advantage of filmmakers. And that's the kind of thing that people may submit to it once, but they'll know better the next time.
Right. So it's using the analogy for the writer types, these, won't call them scams, but these things where people pay to be in an anthology or pay to have their work presented and maybe show it up in an anthology or try and win like a contest?
Yeah. I mean... Yeah. That's how it goes. That's how we pay for ourselves.
Right.
Festival has to rent a movie theater. Hopefully it's not just a convention festival where they have a banquet room that doesn't cost them any extra money. To me, a real festival is in a movie theater or some sort of really cool venue. So there's a value there if the filmmaker is able to come. What we do and what a lot of other festivals do is if you submit your film to the festival, you automatically get a pass or two free passes for the entire festival. That doesn't help a guy out in New Mexico, but a lot of filmmakers in Ontario and in Western New York, they can use those. So
right.
we don't feel too bad about it, and our prices are reasonable.
Cool. I'm going to change gears for a second and throw out, seeing as how now we're talking less about Killer Rack and more about other stuff, let's throw on a excerpt from the movie, and you don't know have any idea which excerpt I picked, but as soon as the Dr. Mr. Raquel starts, I'm pretty sure you'll know which one.
I bet I do.
AW, throw it on.
Who threw this coat rack on me? Never mind about that. It's time for promotions. You get a promotion, and you get a promotion, and you get a promotion. You definitely get a promotion.
Not so fast. You're forgetting about the most qualified person in this office.
Oh, Tim, thank you.
Me!
Sweet memory, Jemba. You, sir, are now president of this company. Bow down before the great and powerful Tits. I'm sorry, I mean Tim. Oh, the hell with it. I'm going with Tits.
Oh, don't worry. I haven't forgotten about you.
You're fired, Quiz Sanchez.
It was horrible, Doctor. Everyone had these large breasts, and I know that you said that it's not important, but I just can't stop thinking about them.
This is perfectly normal. You just have to remember one little thing. I lied. Now get out of here, you breastless freak of nature!
All you need's a pair of fun bags, and you'll never be a fag, hey!
They're flappy and slappy, they make me very happy, they make me want to bust out into song.
All you need's a pair of fun bags, a pair of knockers to make Dutch gag.
I'm scouting the mountains for lactose fountains, memories to make Rushmire cry.
The sight of your breasts makes me quake. I don't even care that they're fake.
My heart and soul are yearning to feel. I know if I can touch them, they're real!
Woohoo! All you need's a pair of fun bags, a pair of cacas that will not sag.
We call them whoppers, poppers, big gobstoppers, Godzillas that will crush you in your sleep.
All you need's a pair of fun bags, a leather teddy and a ball gag.
Bazoomas, palookas, guns like bazookas, PS puppies pushing in your puss. How's that for alliteration?
All you need's a pair of fun bags. All you need's a pair of fun bags. All you need's a pair of fun bags. All you need's a pair of fun bags.
And we're back.
Well, I'm glad you played such a long clip because it gave me a chance to go pour my coffee.
Excellent. But I got to tell you, I howled out laugh as soon as that song came on in the movie. I giggled continuously for a little while.
Thank you. I think all the music you hear there, especially including in the intro, where the characters are talking, is really good. That the first portion has a real Twin Peaks like sound quality to it,
mm-hmm.
And the musicians, Armand Petrie and Joe Rosler, are longtime professionals. Armand has been studio engineer and producer for 10,000 Maniacs and Goo Goo Dolls, and Joe has been the arranger for some heavy metal bands, big ones, Man of War.
Excellent band.
I'm friends with Armand's wife, who is an actress and appeared in a couple of films that I did, Dry Bones, and I produced The Legend of Six Fingers, which he was in. And she was babysitting my daughter, and somehow he got stuck driving her home. And she's typically very shy around let's say, middle-aged and older men. And somewhere along the ride, she opened up to him, and he walked into the house and said, "Are you making a movie about killer boobs? I have to be involved." As it turns out, he used to record audio commentaries, audio tracks for Anchor Bay and Blue Underground and all these different specialty horror DVD companies. So he's a real diehard horror fan. And he spent decades fixing other people's music and songs and stuff. And it was his first chance to do his own music. And he brought in Joe Rosler, and they did the songs, and they did all the instrumental music. And it's a really good score.
I would agree. That's why I was saying this middle song, with the clip there with all the fun bags, was hilarious.
Well, the aside there, which I should have gotten to in my long anecdote there, is that the three scenes that we had for Lloyd Kaufman, they were all pretty short and minor, and that musical number wasn't there. And I've always wanted to do a horror film where it breaks out into a musical number in the middle of the film, like without explanation, and then reverts back to a horror film. I've never had the opportunity. And I felt like that scene probably needed a musical number, but I didn't want to make things harder on us than they already were. And once Armand created the Killer Rack theme song, he was walking around the house and he said to his wife, Kim, "This whole film should be a musical." Now, I wasn't going to go that, but I just needed to hear that to say that my instincts that the scene with Lloyd should be a musical were right. I said, okay, we're going to do this. So he created the song, and Kim choreographed it. And that was a lot of fun to shoot and was pretty easy to shoot. But we did have to play that song over and over and over. And you can imagine it stayed in our brains for a long time.
I would definitely imagine, because it's actually been staying in my brain now for at least 3 or 4 days since I've seen it, and I've been mentioning it to a couple of people. It's like, yeah, you got to watch this movie, because it's like there's this one scene in the middle, it's hilarious. And I don't think I've ever seen Kaufman sing in a movie bit before.
Well, he had his own musical number in Poltergeist, and I think I had forgotten that.
That would do it.
But I knew that he could do it in any case. And there's that one line in the song where he says, "How's that for alliteration?" He ad-libbed that. He can't stick to the script. So he ad-libbed that. It was very funny, and it worked out well.
It worked, because it wouldn't have thought of it as being anything else but part of the thing. But cool. So are you one of these guys that think music is an important part of the movie?
Oh, sure. Especially since on low-budget films, you often have bad room tone and audio dropouts, and music helps cover all that up.
Oh, okay.
But we knew going, Armand and I discussed pretty extensively what kind of music we wanted throughout it, and then he went off on his own and took about half of what we agreed on and came up with his own stuff, and I loved all of it.
Well, the opening theme song, Killer Rack, was pretty good, too.
Yeah, I love that.
Don't remember it as much, but as soon as it starts playing, oh, yeah, okay. But
it's
the fun bag one.
Fast and kind of punk.
Yeah.
So and it doesn't have the visual aid because it's running during the titles. But I think it's just as good a song. And he also did the heavy metal song, I want to Love You. I Want to Hold You, I Want to Love You, I Want to Fuck You is his heavy metal song.
Gotcha. But he didn't do the disco song there in the bar, right?
Correct. That was Brooke Lewis's song. She did a freestyle song like 10 years ago, and my wife kept listening to it because my wife likes freestyle. And was like, yeah, that'll work in the bar. So that was the one piece that came from an outside artist.
Okay.
So Brooke is the voice of the boobs and the person who sings the song that we loop over and over for like a 5-minute sequence.
Yeah, it was like there's a 20-second bit, and it's just the same bit over and over and over again. It's like, no, this is what I hated about disco.
Yeah, that's dance music. That it doesn't have the nuances of thrash metal.
Right. Exactly. Because at least thrash metal has a point somewhere in the whole subtext of its song. There's a point there. Yeah, I didn't like that thing. Oh, okay. But no, that's cool. That was fun. I have completely lost track of what I had in my head right now.
We were blathering about music.
Yes. That was true. We were. And film
everything
festivals.
Everything there was to say about music.
Yes. It's, well, without comparing other movies and how they use music, I got a real big kick out of... You've seen Guardians of the Galaxy, right?
I have. I can't say I remember the music cues.
Oh, no, I mean, I just like the whole idea where they build the music in as part of the actual movie.
Right.
So, I mean, I thought that's a beautiful thing, and I'd like to see more films do that without being an actual musical.
Well, that's kind of what Coppola did with Apocalypse Now.
True. Yep. Definitely true there. So, I like to see that because I think it's a great technique. But it is what it is. Moving there. So you've been getting some rad reviews for this movie already.
It has been something to behold. I mean, we've gotten 12 reviews. 11 of them have been through the roof fantastic. One of them was mixed. It wasn't bad, but it was mixed. Uh-huh. I haven't had reviews like this as a filmmaker, you know, the 30 years I've been doing this.
Really? I would have thought you would have gotten a few positive reviews for Snow Sharks.
Well, I produced Snow Shark. I didn't write or direct it, so I can take neither credit nor the blame, except for helping get it made.
Oh, okay.
And giving a young kid his start.
Gotcha. What about Dry Bones?
Dry Bones got some decent reviews, got a couple of bad ones. Largely, it didn't get many reviews at all. I mean, we've gotten as many reviews for this in the last month as that's gotten the whole year it's been out.
Oh.
See, when I read this script, I knew not only did I know how to make the film, but I knew how to market it.
Gotcha.
And I marketed the hell out of it. I mean, we got 20,000 views on the trailer the first week it was live on YouTube, which is phenomenal for an indie film.
Nice.
We got the coverage on IO9 and Movie Pilot and... the awareness of the film before any of the reviews appeared was already pretty strong.
And do we ascribe some of that to just purely the title of the movie?
Well, I ascribe it to the marketing brilliance of the PR person who was
absolutely
the film. But certainly, the title was strong ammunition and was a big part of my realizing, oh, wow, I can really get this out there.
Because the number of people I've mentioned it to in the last few days, the thing that always gets people hooked is like, I'm sorry, it's called what? Yeah, that's what I said. It's called Killer Rack. It's like, okay, they can get behind that.
I've had many instances where people say Killer Rat. Killer Rack. Rack. Oh!
Make a world of difference. A Killer Rat, that's been done many, many times. I mean, I've seen Ben and Willard and Ben again.
Of unknown origin.
And then there's a scene in Descent, and there's a few other scenes in a bunch of other movies where it's like, oh yeah, killer rats, they're everywhere.
Deadly eyes.
Yep.
Not to be confused with a rat dragging a pizza down the steps.
No, let's not confuse
that. And why did that go viral? Because, I mean, the rat left the pizza and ran away. It didn't even commit.
Why anything goes viral on the internet is sometimes... It's Darwin doesn't even understand it sometimes. Why did the fight scene between two ladies in a Walmart go viral? I don't understand sometimes.
Because guys like to watch chicks fight, and chicks like to watch chicks fight.
Sure, but it just...
That's the perfect Thunderdome.
Okay, we'll go with that. I have nothing more on that one to say, but okay. So how do you find social marketing to help doing, getting the name out, the word out and everything else with that?
Well, it sure eats up a lot of my time. I'll tell you that much. Every time one of these reviews comes out, you know, I got to share it on my page, on my author page, on the film page, on the private production page, on the local horror page, maybe a couple of the other sites out there, Twitter. It's a lot of posting and reposting, but you know, you see people responding to it and then reposting it and sharing it, and that's how you get word out there. But, I mean, it's totally guerrilla marketing.
Right. And do you find that with this movie, the way that it's been coming through, that it's easier to put that message out?
Yeah. I mean, when a film gets a great review, it's a lot easier to say, hey, read this great review than, hey, read this excerpt. It sounds like it's positive.
Okay. Yeah, I can definitely see how the enthusiasm is a lot more in the first than it is on the second. No, I mean with just the visuality and the concept stuff on it, it does it get more play from like the name and from just the, hey, look, it's a chick with big boobs that has these tentacle-y type things coming out?
I don't know. I would think at this point, most everyone that is hearing about it through social media has heard about it quite a bit over the last year and a half, because we did the crowdfunding campaigns, you know, and we kept enthusiasm going, and now the reviews are out there. And I think people, more than anything, people are surprised it's getting good reviews, and that after all this talking, you know, it's something actually worth going out to catch. But I wonder how far the reach is beyond that. I think the real help is the reviews. For instance, the two video reviews, one of them has had 6,000 views and the other one has had 2,500. Conceivably, that's 8,500 people who have been exposed to the film in some way that aren't people I know. I mean, I'm sure a percentage of them are, but when something starts catching on and catching support like that, that's really how work gets out.
Cool. And do you find Facebook, using Facebook as a primary example, because that's what everybody else's life is derived on nowadays, I use that tongue in cheek, is Facebook a better marketing proponent for this, or is it just sort of, it's just another thing there?
Well, it's been a primary one for me, and I certainly use it a lot. Like I said, I do all the reposting, and it's not just the reviews, it's every time we get accepted by a festival, it's every time we plan to attend a festival, if there's a festival award nomination, if we win an award. I mean, this is all stuff to go into the pipeline. And what you hope is that the other people around you are also sharing these, and some do and some don't. But I mean, it's that repetition that gets it out there, especially with, you know, the algorithms that Facebook uses, where only 10% of the people on you that are on at a time may even see your post.
Right.
You have to keep repeating the information. It gets pretty soul-crushing on my end of the terminal at times, but you just have to keep the enthusiasm up.
Yeah, it's the thing that I call the density equation. Once it gets to a certain point in contacts, it starts growing on its own.
But
until then,
exactly.
You've got to keep managing it until it gets to that point.
Exactly. And, I mean, Monday, I had so much work to do on different projects I'm involved with, but we got two different great reviews that day and a festival acceptance, and each festival sends you the Ivy Laurels. You know, once you get accepted, that's great. You can't wait to share the news, but then you have to wait for the festival to announce it. And then after the festival announces it, you have to wait for those laurels to come in. So there's so much waiting involved with this whole festival process. But I had all this work to do, and then I had all that news happen on the same day, and just sharing that on all those different Facebook pages and on Twitter, it just devoured my day.
Well, you know what they say, Facebook is a time suck.
It is. It is a time suck.
It is, but it's there, it's got a purpose. So it's always positive point. I did have one more real question that I had remembered earlier but completely forgot, so I'm gotten back to it now that I remember it, and it's about the tentacles.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a comment somewhere about saying it's not CG, it's all puppetry, animatronic stuff.
Well, there are, the tentacles do come out of the tits. You actually see that in the ending. There are maybe four shots of this. One of them is a shot where the tentacles, you know, Betty hugs a guy to her and the tentacles come out of his back and spring around and then get sucked back into her and he dies. And those, I guess, are probably what they're referring to as the sci-fi channel type effects. I mean, I'm not being defensive about this at all. And those have a cartoony feel to it, and it's actually, they were actually puppeted, like against a green screen or something, and then comped in.
Right.
Then the other things that you see that actually come out and then go in the air and pick up this woman, pick her up, those are stop-motion animation. And Brett Piper sculpted these. They were like 2 feet long stop motion puppets of the tentacles, and had to work around those with the actresses and stuff. So stop motion is a very time consuming craft. And I've long wanted to have stop motion in one of my films, and I've long wanted Brett to do it, and we got it. We got our stop motion monster, and people keep calling it Sci-Fi Channel CGI. So I guess it's so smooth that it looks like CGI, but it's stop motion animation, for God's sake.
Well, stop motion's awesome. I mean, look at Ray Harryhausen's work in the past. Yeah. Look at the videos for Tool. All sorts of stuff that really looks cool and very done. But yeah, it takes, what, for like a 1 minute shot in stop motion, it takes like, what, up to an hour?
I don't know what the time would be, but I know it's, you take two frames for every movement. So for a second, you have to move that thing 12 times.
Right. So somebody who wants to do the math can figure that out, and that takes a while.
But we did shoot, the actresses green screen. So the actresses and the tentacles are comped in over a background. So that's probably what makes people think it's CGI, but it's not.
Cool. And that would make sense with my visual impression that I got it for it a bit. It's like, wait a second, that looks like a little CGI. It's like, but how did he get CGI in this movie? It doesn't seem like that would be a thing that he would do in this movie. That would explain that.
We've had CGI. I mean, we had CGI in Slime City Massacre, too. And that, like, this is a film that's, you know, part of the charm and appeal is the practical effects. Right. But there is use for CGI, usually in combination with that, you know, smoothing things out or fixing things. And in Killer Rack, in fact, in the sequence where she disrobes and you actually see her full breast, not in a monster form, the appliance kept peeling up around them. And no disrespect to Eric Zemecki, our effects artist, who did all those wonderful creatures, but they didn't work. It didn't look at least look convincing, and our CGI guy then got rid of those seams.
Nice.
So it's practical and the CGI working together that pulled it off. And instances like that happened on Slime City Massacre too.
So it's the cleanup crew.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, we're pretty much at the end of this hour, and this has been a wonderfully exciting and interesting time filled with information and stuff. How do people follow you even more?
Facebook. Either Gregory Lamberson, Gregory Lamberson, author and filmmaker, or Killer Rack Movie. Also, the Jake Hellman Files, my novel series, or Johnny Gruesome. They all have their own Facebook pages.
How many Facebook pages are you managing?
I probably manage like 12, you know, because I have the film festival. And I have a film professionals association here in Buffalo, and I've got the werewolf book. So, I mean, there's a lot of them.
Cool. Well, I just wanted to say thanks for coming on the show. You've been a wonderful guest with a lot of sparkling qualities of information and talking stuff.
I'm here to educate as well as entertain.
Education and entertainment is good.
I'm like PBS when Spider-Man is on it.
Wait. Spider-Man was... No, he wasn't.
Zoom.
Cool. Well, again, thanks for coming on the show. Everybody else in After Outlawn, feel free to come back many, many times every Wednesday. Check out this movie, Killer Rack. Do you have an actual official release date for it yet?
Nope. We're just going to be doing festivals for the next 6 months, and I imagine it'll be out on DVD maybe in 9 months.
Blu-ray release expectation?
I can't say. My regular distributor, Pop Cinema, that's put out most of my movies, they don't do Blu-rays because not enough horror fans buy Blu-rays, believe it or not.
Oh, they don't talk to me. I buy everything on Blu-ray if I can.
But they don't talk to people. They look at sales figures and returns.
Right.
And the payoff just isn't there for Blu-ray for low-budget films with a niche audience. I mean, if you're Scream, of course you sell enough Blu-rays, but... So if I go with them, it'll just be DVD. And if I go with somebody else, I imagine it will be Blu-ray. But, these days the indie market has all gone to video on demand, digital download, all that stuff.
Gotcha. Well, cool. Have fun. May you do exceedingly well and tip-top tits in the movie. See, I'm using my pun powers there,
tit
too.
Tit for tat.
Tit for tat and the kit for cats. And I think after this, EW has his show on as well. And I think we're going to wrap that up right there.
Good night, America and Canada.
And other places in the world, too.
Spain, France, Japan, all the markets.
A few of them.
of a big surprise. If you go down in the woods today, you better go in disguise. For every bear that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day that teddy bears have their pick.